Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio.
Christopher Hughes is chief of the Anglesey Druid Order, a Mount Haemus scholar, and a member of the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids. He is a teacher, writer, workshop leader, and guest speaker at pagan conferences, camps, and festivals throughout the United Kingdom, Europe, and North America. Christopher has also contributed to Welsh and English television and radio. He works professionally for Her Majesty's Coroner Service and is a teacher of deaf midwifery. He lives on the Isle of Anglesey, just off the northern coast of Wales. He's the creator of the Celtic Tarot and the author of 4 books, including his latest, The Book of Druidry. Christopher Hughes, welcome to Witchlit.
Hello, I'm excited to be here. How are you?
I'm super excited to be here. And I think based on our previous conversation, a couple of things in your bio may have changed.
So. Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. I thought, oh, some of that has changed.
But that's okay. I mean, you did work for Hermit, or I guess now His Majesty's.
I know that was a really difficult thing to get my head around as well, because I've been so used to saying I worked for Her Majesty's Coroner, and now of course it's His Majesty's Coroner, which is really peculiar. But I no longer work for His Majesty's Coroner.
Right.
I work in television. I work in Welsh language television as a television presenter. And a druid and a writer. So there's a lot going on.
I'm unsurprised by the television presenter because you have a lovely voice. So.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for bringing it on the show. I hope people enjoy listening. So our first question for everyone on the show is kind of in this, you know, age of television and social media and YouTube and all of this stuff. Why still write? Why still write books?
There's something so tactile about a book, and I've been obsessed with books since I was a young child. If given the opportunity as a child, I would rather spend time in the woods reading a book than go out playing with my friends. But I realized that I had to have some kind of a compromise, so I had at least some chance at socialization. So I would get up really early and take my book either into the garden or into the woods or down to the river. And I would read, and it's something I still do every morning. I get up and I read a few pages, even if it's just 2 pages of a book. Mm-hmm. I feel that it gives my day a really nice little kickstart, and nothing beats the smell of a book, the tactile nature of a book, and it feels like a companion. And whilst I'm an avid podcast listener and I love listening to different shows through my headphones when I'm at the gym or I'm out walking, nothing beats curling up with a book on a dark, stormy winter's night or just on the beach in the height of summer. Yeah. It's comforting and friendly and warm, whatever the year, whatever the weather. And I don't think anything beats a book. And although I have a Kindle, I've got one of those contraptions, I find the entire experience somewhat discombobulating because you touch a screen rather than turn a page. And there's just something so tactile about turning a page. So I think that's why. And also when I wrote my first book, because I'm obsessed with the smells of books, I thought to myself, what if my author copies turn up and they stink? What am I going to do? If they don't smell good, you know, I think I do judge a book by its smell. They smell fine. It was really good.
That fresh print smell, yes.
There's just something about that smell that gives me a really nice warm tingling feeling.
Yeah. I'm a printer's daughter, though. He did not print books, but I'm a printer's daughter. And so that ink smell is
so you're familiar kind of
ingrained.
With that smell.
Yeah, it's kind of ingrained in my memory. So
Yeah. And I think there must be different qualities of ink because some books smell better than others.
Yes. Well, and I think of like old books have that like almost vanilla smell from the lignin and the wood. I guess as it decays, it gives off this vanilla smell.
Yes. I do tend to collect old books. So this one's an old book that I've just received, and it smells like vanilla. Yeah, it's exquisite. Mm-hmm. Vanilla and tobacco. And I don't know, moonlight and mountains and rivers.
It's absorbed all of that. Smell.
I have several old books that are pertinent to my druidry and to my research. And the room that houses those books is down on the other side of my house. And that room smells of them.
Yeah, that library smell. Like you said, leather and tobacco and vanilla. And like, it's such a amazing how many scented candle companies have that library smell.
It's so true, isn't it? Yes, it's so true.
So what was your writing journey to publishing? Like, did you write all that time when you were a kid reading to you, or did writing come later?
I used to write when I was a child, but I used to write stories for my friends. And which is peculiar because I'm not a novel reader. I very, very rarely read novels, but I did used to write stories as a child. Mm-hmm. I think I just had a very vivid imagination. And then as I grew up, I stopped writing those stories. And I was at a Druid festival in 2005, 2004, maybe. And I'd given a workshop, and this guy came up to me at the end of it and said, "Have you ever considered writing a book?" And I looked at him and said, "No." He said, "Well, would you like to write me a book for my company?" And my initial response was, "Well, no, I'm Welsh." And I was like, "I can't write a book in English. Are you mad?" No, and I eventually said that to him. I said, I can't write a book in English. I can barely speak it. He said, "Well, why don't you have a go?" So I thought, well, I haven't got anything to lose, you know? So I had a go and suddenly found that I really enjoyed the process of getting my thoughts about my spirituality and spiritual practice down on paper. I found it incredibly cathartic. But at the same time, I didn't have a clue how to write. Not a clue. I didn't know what the rules of paragraphing were. I was absolutely clueless, floundering around in the dark. And I thought, well, they'll help, you know, they'll help me through the process. So I sent it in and they published it. And it was a little bit like, it was like a narcotic. I was suddenly hooked on the idea that, gosh, perhaps I could sit in my office at home and write, and for it to not be purely indulgent, even though I think an element of it is indulgent, but that I could do it almost as a semi-professional thing. And I haven't stopped since.
There you go.
You know, it just carried on from then. It snowballed from there. But this was a very small British publishing house. And my first two books are with them, which is peculiar because whenever somebody reads out my Llywelyn Worldwide biography, it doesn't include those books. Mm-hmm. I say, well, actually, there's another two out there as well from a British publisher. But I'd long admired, and if you look at my bookcase, there are dozens, if not, well, probably hundreds of books with that little crescent moon on the side.
Yeah.
All the way back from like the 1980s. And the very first book that I'd picked up with that little crescent moon on it was called Magical Herbalism by Scott Cunningham. I think he wrote it in, I don't know, 1982 or something. And I found it in a secondhand bookshop. And it is still one of my favorite books that introduced me to paganism and magic and occulture in general. I thought, well, maybe one day I could write for them. And my partner said, well, why don't you just send the manuscript out that I was working on at the, I think it was like 2009. Why don't you send it in? They can only say no. And then what's the worst that can happen? So I thought, oh, I can't, the audacity of it, you know, of sending it to Llywelyn Worldwide. So I did, and they bought it. So I've been with them ever since. And that was 2011, I think my first book came out with them. And and I've been with them since. It's been quite a fabulous journey, but a journey as well that I never expected it to change my life in the way that it did. It completely changed my life. My life does not resemble anything of the life that I had in the noughties. It just completely changed it. Just from writing a book. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Those books are powerful. I'm curious, have you only published in English or have you published in Welsh as well?
I've published in Welsh as well. And I remember having this conversation with my editor for my first book, because she realized that some of my sentence structures belie the fact that English is not my first language. Mm-hmm. And I think they must have stopped and thought, what do we do about that? But they decided to just run with it because that's me, I guess. It's my voice. And English is very much my second language. I struggled with English as a child dreadfully. I struggled so, so terribly with my grasp of the English language. And I had extracurricular lessons in English because I just could not get my head around it at all. So I think in Welsh, I dream in Welsh. All of my familial connections are Welsh. Mm-hmm. So writing in English is something that I've had to exercise. And it is a muscle, isn't it? Learning any language is a muscle. And I think that as soon as you start to think in that other language, I think that denotes fluency. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, as I'm speaking to you, I'm not thinking in Welsh. I'm not translating stuff from Welsh to English in my brain. It's an automatic process because I can think in English now. So it was a really peculiar process. And also, I thought it was very sweet of my editors to realize that an author also has a unique voice, mm-hmm. even if sometimes the way that they might say something might not be quite to the rules, you know, but it's nice that it's there. So now I just, but then again, I've learned a little bit more with each book. I think you learn, and with each editing process, you learn a little bit more, even though the first time those editing notes arrived, I think I went and sat in that corner over there and cried for 3 hours, you know, because it felt like it was personal attack.
Yes.
It was so, so traumatic. But now I understand that the editor's job is to make you the best writer that they can get you to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a difficult one.
No, but I mean, reading your book, like, you do have a very distinct voice in the book. I don't think I picked up that it necessarily sounded like someone who is writing in their second language. Like, it just kind of has this very, I don't know, there's just like a flow to your writing that it's very easy to read. It's kind of just like you can sink in and just kind of, you know, look up 50 pages later and go, oh, I've been here a while.
I love it when that happens, though, don't you?
Yeah.
It's just like the most amazing thing. I'm having that happen to me right now with a friend of mine in South Wales recently wrote a book. And I'm in the middle of reading hers. And exactly what you've just described, I look up and I think, oh, gosh, 25 pages have gone.
Yeah, you don't even realize. Yeah. Well, especially I was reading it in an e-galley. So I do read on my iPad a lot.
Right.
Mostly just because until very recently lived in an apartment and had very limited space. So e-books took up a lot less shelf space.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I do like to read on the iPad because my vision is not great. So I can blow up the text.
Of course.
Helps. Yeah.
Yeah. Get it to a nice, comfortable size.
Yeah, exactly. So that's always helpful. But no, I just really enjoyed reading it. And in the introduction, you have this, like, you're going to give this kind of overview of Druidry from like the stages of Druidism, I guess. Which I was like, oh, this is going to be like a lot, but it doesn't come across that way. Like, you do have there's so much information in there, but it's just kind of like taking a walk with a friend almost, I guess. Like,
oh, thank you.
Because you do incorporate this history and kind of talk about like where modern Druidry comes from, but it doesn't feel like a history lesson. It feels like you just need these pieces so we can talk.
Yes. And you know, it's funny that you should mention that it feels like going for a walk with a friend, because that's almost what I have in my mind when I am writing. Mm-hmm. I have in my mind that I'm going to write this for my friend. So this particular book, The Book of Druidry, I wrote for my friend Mavanui, and Mavanui died in 2006, and she can't read my books anymore. So I write them to her, or I wrote this one to her. And it feels as if I take her hand and I say, come on, let's go for a walk in the woods and I'll tell you all about Druidry.
I love that.
And my oldest and closest friend died last year. She was only 62. And the book that I'm writing at the moment is for her. And I find that that helps me to have in mind one person. And I'm going to tell them all about my book by writing it to them. Mm-hmm. And I hope then that that comes across. And what you've just described makes me very happy.
Oh, no. Well, clearly it's working, or it worked on me. So.
Oh, thank you. That's really lovely. That's touched me very deeply, because that's exactly the intention that, you know, I have in these tiny little books.
Yeah. And it's one of the things I really like about it too, is that, like I said, there's a lot of information there, kind of, you know, like the history, and then also these different aspects of what comes together as modern Druidry. And, but you leave so much space in the book for people to write themselves, like, who are they in this tradition? And I just kind of wanted to ask you about that. And like, how did that come about in the book? Like, how do you envision people using the book? Cause I think this really is a book to, you know, to write in, to make your own, in addition to the words that you've given us.
Yes. So, well, I'm going to horrify probably half of your listeners now. And maybe I'm hoping the other half will get what I'm talking about. I'm the breaker of spines and the butcherer of books. I'm terrible. I have antique books, and I get my big fat Mac pen and I scroll all over them and I scribble notes in the margins. I love marginalia. I have so many old books that have got the most fascinating marginalia. And I have books from a local Welsh university. So these things were being used by people who were reading Celtic studies and Celtic literature at the very beginning of the 20th century and the end of the 19th century. And they're writing their thoughts in the marginalia. And I've learned so much about the very subjects that I've been researching by reading these tiny little marginalia scripts. And I do exactly the same thing. I tend to stick those little, you know, those little miniature post-it notes. That's it. Yeah, the little, I don't know, what do you call them? Markers?
Yeah, our flags. I call them flags.
Flags, yeah. Yeah. So I stick those in. I'm definitely I always curl a book over, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm terrible, because to me, a book is a friend.
Yeah.
And I feel as if I'm not just in relationship with the words themselves, but also with the physical object that is the book, and also that I'm in relationship with the author for the duration of time that I'm immersed in their words, because I consider, just like I described about my friend, I consider a book that I'm reading to be something that that person wrote just for me. Mm-hmm. They wrote it for me. They didn't write it for anyone else. They just wrote it for me. And whilst I'm in their words, I just love it. I can't describe or fully articulate how much I love the process of being immersed in someone's words. So I do write notes, whether it's in pencil or in my fountain pens. I'm constantly writing notes between the lines, or if there's a tiny gap between paragraphs, I'll fill it in with notes. And I wanted, when I spoke to my editor, I said, is there some way that we can emulate that or mimic that? And she said, of course, we can have your book like a notebook. So, because I'd really love for somebody who's just starting out, or they don't know an awful lot about Druidry, that they can put their thoughts in. And in 20 years' time, they might look back at it, or somebody might find it in a secondhand bookstore, and it will have all of this personal stuff in from a person that they will never have met, and mm-hmm. a person that might not even be alive anymore by that point. I love that a book is not only the continuation of the words that have been created by an author, but that it can also be a continuation of the relationship the reader had with that book. Mm-hmm. So I consider them to be friends. And because I'm a druid, I also have an understanding an experiential understanding, I believe, of the animistic principle in a book. And in Druidry, that is a really important part of our tradition. We call it bardism, that words are inherently alive. Whether you write them, if you write them, they're basically talismans and sigils. It's a symbolic craft. And then when you read them out, they come alive. It's something that is, on one hand, it looks dead, but it's alive. It's alive, but it's also dead. So to me, a book embodies the oral tradition of Druidry. It embodies it because it has the potential to bring something to life in the imagination of the reader. Mm-hmm. So I'm a firm believer in the animistic principle within a book. So to me, scribbling and writing in a book is an act of love and devotion. It's almost depending on the book, it's almost an act of worship. You know,
I
adore it. But some people break their hearts when they'll come and scour my bookcases and they'll go, oh my gosh, you've got a first edition Ivor Williams, Pedraid Cainc y Mabinogi, and they open it and they go, oh, covered in yellow highlighter ink. But to me,
because it's yours,
love.
And I joke that I am, in many people's eyes, the destroyer of books. Because I love them. I love, like, you know, like if I have a book of poetry, I will dog ear the ones I want to go back to and read over and over again.
Oh, hell yes.
I'll put flags in it. I'll underline and marginalia the whole thing. And it to me, like you said, it's like a conversation with the book between me and the book.
Exactly that. It's not one dimensional. It's not a one way street.
Yeah.
It's the epitome of being in relationship with something.
And I do have some books that I might be a little more standoffish with. And if I feel way about them, I will buy a second edition, a second copy for myself.
Yes, 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 exactly. Yeah. I do have one or two, and maybe because they're exquisitely beautiful, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the scene is like in the United States, but at the moment here in Britain, we've recently had an upsurge in small, exquisite publishing houses that produce these occult books that are works of art.
Yeah,
they're stunning. Troy Books is one of them over here. Black Letter Press, I think, is another one. Oh my word, these things are incredibly beautiful, and I don't have the heart to break their spines.
But they usually sell a paperback of the same edition, and that's...
They will always sell a paperback. Yes. And I recently, I can't even put my hands on it right away. I got one, something called, is it called Treading the Wheel? Traditional Norfolk Witchcraft or something. I can't remember. Can't remember what it's called. But I just recently ordered a paperback so that I can, you know...
it's one of the things I do like about reading on the... So I usually read in Apple Books because I have an iPad and I find it the native app works best on it. But I have my little Apple stylus, and those look like I'm grading high school papers because I just write all over it, and underline and highlight and make notes on little post-its that show up on it. And so, yeah, I love that too.
I'm not entirely sure how many people actually do it in reality, even though I encourage people for any of my books. You know, you might want to have a little journal or something if you plan to work with this book. But I do have journals for books that I read. Or I have a large journal in which I will put thoughts from a book into it. And I find that those things as well develop eventually, or they might contribute to my own writing, you know, and inspire me to go down a particular rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So they are very much products of relationships. So I was at a conference recently in Minnesota, and a lady came up to me after one of my presentations with a book that she'd already bought a couple of years ago, and it was falling apart. It was in a dreadful state. And it made me so happy because she'd loved this book, and she kind of, like, it was quite embarrassing. I think she knew more about that book than I did, and I wrote the bloody thing. But she loved it. And it filled me with so much joy that, you know, it's still nice when somebody comes up to you with a pristine copy that they just got from Llewellyn or from Amazon. But there's something quite special when they've butchered it.
Yeah. And digested
it, or they've eaten it, literally.
Mm-hmm. There's a, I can't remember the name of the people who started it, but there's like a cookbook book blog called Stained Pages, and kind of talking about how, like, in your cookbooks, the recipes you use all the time, those pages get stained, you know, and how, like, my mom had a copy of, like, Good Housekeeping's cookbook, you know, and it was like her cooking Bible in the kitchen and everything, you know, she'd always look in it. And when she died, my sister and I kind of both wanted it, but I said, you know, go take it. Cause it was like literally held together with duct tape. I mean, it was falling apart. And so I told my sister to take it. And I said, I will find a secondhand copy. And I just want to copy mom's marginalia out of that book into the new one, so we can both have a copy. And the thing that was the funniest thing is when I ordered it online and it came, it was literally half an inch slimmer than the one that my sister had, because of the stuff stuck in the pages and like the recipes my mom had shoved in and like just expanded the spine of the book.
Yeah.
And it's like seriously a book that, you know, we got used from the 1940s until she died in the 2000s, you know. Like,
yeah. I have two books here that my grandmother owned, one called The Cookery Year. And I think that was published in, 1953 or something. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of other recipes stapled into it. It's a hot mess, this book. And I imagine it's got God knows what kind of bacteria growing in it, because there's...
You could start your own sourdough starter.
But it's really special because she loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love to see those kind of books. And finding, like you said, when you're looking at secondhand books and finding those little gems in there is a true joy to me too. Like, I just, or like things people have shoved in books, and, you know, yeah, I love it.
Yes. Yeah. I have one in particular that it's quite difficult to read. The person must have had incredibly good eyesight, because the writing is minute. It's so, so tiny. And I literally have to take a photograph of the pages on my phone and then upload it to my computer and expand it to be able to read what this person was saying. And some of the stuff is incredible, so insightful. Mm-hmm. So I really value that.
I've even noticed, like, on this topic that I find fascinating. So occasionally I will get ebooks from our local library, you know, just check them out online and read them. And sometimes other people's highlights will stay in the edition.
Right.
It doesn't happen all the time, and I'm not sure what the mechanism, you know, I don't understand the technical specs of it, but occasionally I will be reading a book and stuff will already be highlighted in it. And I'm always curious, like, why did they highlight that? I wish you'd left me a note.
Oh gosh, yeah, that would really pique my curiosity for sure. Mm-hmm.
I love the book as an artifact, though. You're right. It is. Yeah, there is something truly special about this, like you said, however you read, like, there's just something about the book, you know, as a friend, an artifact that I love.
And also, I think because I'm intimately familiar with the process on the other side of the fence, the process of writing the books, it's a really solitary task. I'm here in my office alone for hours and hours, months on end, if you add all that time together. I go to Finland to sit in a cabin deep in the forest by myself to write. It's such a lonely endeavor. And it always surprises me that there are people out there who then go and read it. You know, it's like, oh, actually, it's out there in the world now, and people are actually reading it. Why am I surprised? It's a really, I find the whole thing very magical in a way. Mm-hmm. But it's solitary. You put all your thoughts into a book, and then you send it off to somebody that you might never have met. And then 10 months later, it's released into the world. And in that 10 months, the author has changed and grown. And so even the book that's coming out, The Book of Druidry, now in May of 2023, I'm thinking, oh, I wish I'd have said that Oh, I wish I could put this in it now, but it's too late, of course. Yeah. So I love the fact that it captures, it's like a snapshot of a period in time that is pertinent to my development and my spiritual expression, and that it might add and contribute to another person's development and progression. So none of it actually happens in a vacuum. It's mm-hmm. It all becomes this beautiful concoction that's dreamed up by one person and then becomes a part of somebody else's life. And I don't think I will ever tire of that.
Yeah.
That the realness of it, that when people come up to me in a conference and say, oh, I really enjoyed your words. And when you said this or this happened, I feel as if I have to pinch myself still. Like, gosh, yeah, this thing actually works. And I don't know why I'm surprised, because I have the exact same relationships with the books that I read by mm-hmm. other authors. But it is very surprising what happens to me.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of hope that I'm in the middle of writing my seventh book.
Wow. Yeah.
The sixth one has not come out yet. I've been hanging on to it for a while because I don't think it's ready for prime time yet. But yeah, I hope that weird frisson of reality never goes away with writing. Like, I kind of love it. But to just think, I think the first time I realized that someone I didn't know already had read the book, I had to go lay down for a second.
Yes, I totally get it. It's so peculiar. Mm-hmm. You think, how can what I've done in a tiny little office on an island in North Wales have affected a person who lives in deepest Montana?
Yeah.
And it does.
Yeah. I guess one of the things I do like about Amazon is, like, we, so I initially published with a small kind of hybrid publisher, and then they restructured and I got the rights back to my book. And so my husband and I started our own publishing house to republish the books. And so now I see where they sell, right? Like, I know where they go. And we sold a book in Nigeria.
Really? Wow.
And I was like, I mean, not that, you know, like, it's on Amazon, so anyone in the world can buy the book, yeah. Right? But I was just like, this person that I will never know anything about them, and, you know, across an ocean, bought my book, and maybe they read it. I mean, maybe they just bought it. But yeah, it was kind of like, oh, how is this real? And I think for me, there is a little bit of imposter syndrome in that to you, like, who am I to have this thing out in the world that people are going to buy and read? But
I imagine, I don't think I've met another fellow author who doesn't have imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. really. Yeah. I think it's probably a healthy thing to have. And I have it by the bucket loads, because I'm expecting someone to find me out and for somebody to suddenly shout from the wings, you're not English. What are you doing writing these books? And I'll go to pieces. It's really strange. I'm still expecting people to find me out and find that.
But you tell them right in the beginning that you're not English.
I tell them. So. There's nothing to find out, but I have this imposter screaming mm-hmm. at the back of my head. And but I had this, oh my gosh, this is so indulgent. It was so funny. It was so hilarious. And they've become friends consequently. I was in California, in San Jose, speaking at PantheaCon. And then my partner and I drove from San Jose down to Los Angeles, because I worked in Los Angeles in 1996. And my partner had never been. So we went down and we did, you know, all the stuff, all the haunts that where I used to work and live. And then we went to Universal Studios in Hollywood. And then we were there frightfully early in the morning before there was hardly anybody there. And we saw two men coming towards us, two young guys. And I said, oh, good morning, how are you? And I had a satchel with a Welsh dragon flag on it. And as I said hello to them, one of the guys, his mouth fell open slightly. And then as they walked past, he stopped and then he called, are you Christopher Hughes? And my partner went, oh, God, we're never going to live this one down. And I said, yes. And I thought, oh, he must have been at the conference. He hadn't been to the conference at all. He lived in Phoenix, or still lives in Phoenix, and had come over to Los Angeles to go to Disneyland and Universal Studios and happened to love my books. And he recognized my picture, my face from the picture, and then the red dragon cinched it.
Wow.
And it was the bizarrest moment. And I thought, oh my gosh, all this stuff is really real, isn't it? And we've become really lovely friends since that book. It was so lovely. But that was my moment that my partner said, he's going to need to put butter around the door frame to get his head through it. Which was true for a while. I was like, oh my God, this amazing thing happened to me. I was on the phone to my mother. You'd never guess what just happened in Universal Studios.
Yes.
And,
and I think, like, you know, in like the world of writers is relatively small, right? And like, if you're writing in the occult space, that's even smaller, you know, it's like, and those things still feel enormous. And then I think about, like, I don't know that I would want actual fame. Like, that sounds terrifying. Like, to happen
it?
Like a little bit like that is kind of cool, but to like not be able to leave your house. Like, I can't even imagine what that's like.
No, that must be dreadful. And it's quite, seeing that it's quite peculiar because I'm a writer, but I also work in television, right? So I present on Welsh language television. It's a network called S4C. And they broadcast just Welsh language content. And it's fairly small. You know, we only have 2 million people that live in the country. Mm-hmm. So the amount of people that watch S4C is quite small. And I get recognized when I'm out in the supermarket and stuff. And it's all really lovely. But I have another friend who lives on the island called Kerry Pritchard McLean. And she's a mainstream comedian on English television and radio. And she can't go anywhere. I can go into England and nobody knows who I am. Now, I can wandering around Wales, people might go, oh, you're that bloke off that television program. I say, oh, yes. And they're all very kind and nice about it. Oh, good day. And then off you go. But my friend Kerry, whenever I was in London with her last week recording a show for the BBC, and she just gets spotted by everybody. Oh. I'm like, oh, this is horrific.
Yeah, I can't even
absolutely
imagine.
Horrific.
I can't even imagine what that's like. Yeah, it's not something. I think one of the things I like about being a writer is you can kind of be anonymous still.
Because if your face isn't on the cover, you're even more anonymous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know?
But I think a lot of writers actually like that. I must admit, I put my hands up and will say I do live for the applause. I do like a
there
little bit.
There is no shame in that. There is no shame in that at all.
So when I do get recognized, I do tend to squeal.
Yeah, I mean, I've had it happen, like, not in real time space, but like online. I've had people figure out who I am because, I mean, my name is fairly unique.
Yes. Yes.
And they're always like, "Oh my God, you wrote blah blah blah," and I'm like, "I did." And then I'm like, oh my God, I have to go think about what this means that this person has read my book that I didn't know I was sharing space with people who had actually read my book.
Yes. That is peculiar.
Yeah, it's kind of peculiar.
But I love the whole process. I love all of it. I feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity to begin with. If that man hadn't have just happened to be in my presentation in the early 2000s, this would never have happened, probably.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful, even to him, you know, because he started something that day that I'm very grateful to have in my life. And I really enjoy the process of writing. I do get a little bit dramatic sometimes, you know, and when things aren't flowing right. Ooh. I have a tendency for drama. And
that's what good editors are for. That's what good editors are for.
Yes.
I always say that my editor reins in my tendency to wax too poetic.
Kill your...
She's really good about that. She's really good about that.
Yeah. What's that saying? Kill your darlings. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse, is it?
Her note is usually, this is really beautiful, but I have no idea what you're trying to say here.
It's like when I put in... Not the Book of Druidry. I wrote a book called Ciridwen, Celtic Goddess of Inspiration. That was a whopper. There was, I think, 130,000 words in it, and they said it has to be 98. That's like losing a leg.
You've got a whole other book. You've got a whole second book.
How can I get rid of 30,000 words?
Yeah.
So, but it had to fit in because they understand they're a business, and you know they have their limitations as well in what they're going to throw money at. Mm. Yeah. And I suppose 98,000 words is a safe number for them. But I still have those words. They're still there. I use them in my workshops and stuff, you know. So in a way, they've done me a favor because it doesn't give everything away all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Keep a little back.
I like that. I like that. Yeah, you got to seed for other things, right? You got to seed.
Yes, exactly.
So like when you, like you're in your new project, writing your book to your friend. So what does a new project look like for you? Like how much is research and how much is just kind of diving in and like, what does that process look like for you?
So if at all possible, regardless of the nature of the book, I don't need much of an excuse to go to the library at my local university. So my local university is Prifysgol Bangor, or Bangor University in North Wales. And they have a Welsh department there, which is, you would die. Oh my word, you would just die. It's all red carpets and mahogany shelves and stained glass in this beautiful, impossibly tall, old structure from the 1700s. And the books in there are heavenly. They are literally like my narcotic of choice, you know? And I love and relish any opportunity to just go and sit in there all day long if I can, take my laptop, sit there by the stained glass and just be in amongst all of this beautiful work, even if I only need one line of research. I still love to be there, and mm-hmm. I love the process of research. Because of the nature of what I write, I get to indulge in the privilege of having access to these amazing books written in my language. Some of them are hundreds of years old. So I have to incorporate a little bit of that just so that I can go there and spend time there justifiably.
Yeah. Oh, no, that sounds lovely. I do have a question that I was thinking about that. Like, I studied Old English in my graduate degree. And like, I think about like, it's like Old English is unintelligible to modern English readers.
Yeah.
And Middle English, you're getting closer. Like Chaucer on, you can kind of suss things out. So what is that like reading in Welsh? Like how different it, you know, where is the ancient Welsh line where like a modern Welsh speaker would have trouble?
So it's a similar process, I guess, to the way English developed. So Middle Welsh, which is the majority of research material that I have to access for my work, comes from the Middle Welsh era. So you're looking at the period from around 1100 to 1600. And Middle Welsh, there's some differences, but I nobody had to teach me how to read it.
Mm-hmm.
I can read it. I can extrapolate the information from there. But to, I guess, somebody who has never read any Middle Welsh before, even if they're a native speaker, they would probably struggle to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
They would get the knack of it. There is a knack to understanding that if you see a T and it's after a vowel, it's pronounced as a D. So there's just these small rules. And once you've grasped a handful of those, it's okay. But when you get to Old Welsh, that language is closer to Brythonic, to Celtic British. So, and that developed between around 550 to about 750. So it took about 200 years for that to evolve out of common Brythonic. And that's, again, I can read some of that. There's not an awful lot of that left, mm-hmm. examples of it, but I can read some of it. And that takes just a little bit more concentration. But essentially, the differences between modern Welsh and ancient Welsh are not that massive.
Mm-hmm.
They just take a little bit of time for you to settle into it. But I love that as well. I love the fact that my spoken language connects me to all of this history, mm-hmm. this pool of history. But also the language itself evolved simultaneously with the bardic arts. So we have particular strict form of bardism in Wales. One is called Canghanedd, which essentially means harmony or music that is chained or restricted into words. And it involves internal alliteration and rhyme. And the beautiful thing about Cynghanedd is that Cynghanedd and Welsh, they evolved simultaneously. Mm-hmm. They fed one another. So we're essentially a bardic language. And whether you're orating poetry or singing a song, we don't differentiate between music and poetry. We consider that both of them are acts of singing. So we only have the one term for vocalizing, you know, reciting a poem or singing a song. And it's the same word, can, C-A-N. And so I love that that musicality is infused into my language and that they evolved together. They needed one another for their development, for their evolution. And that that musicality is still so inherently is a beautiful expression of the mm-hmm. common language today. And I get to write about that. I get to study that. I get to research that. And it makes my heart sing because whether I'm in a relationship with a book or whether I'm sitting in that library, which is just to die, and I can feel almost the echoes of my ancestors singing from the shelves. So the research might only be very minimal for one or two of the books, but I still go through the rigmarole and the process just as... Mm-hmm. So when I wrote my Ceridwen book, there was a lot of research. I needed to access a lot of old Welsh poetry and then translate it. So I spent an awful lot of time, but I'll go and spend an awful lot of time in there even if I don't need a lot of research.
Oh, I love that. I wish audio only format. I wish people could see the joy on your face. Like, it is clear... that this is truly a joy for you.
I remember saying to my partner when I was writing the Book of Druidry, and you know, there was some research involved in that, but not as intensively as Ceridwen. I said, "Oh, I need to go to the library today." "Oh, okay. What for? Which bit are you writing about?" "Oh, the Mabinogi." And he was like, "You know everything about the Mabinogi. What more could you possibly need to know?" I said, "No. There's one thing. I need to go." "I'll be home at 6.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
No, libraries are the best. Like, I don't have that same... I mean, I think of them as ancestors' ideas, I guess. But, you know, being American mutt, it that changes the situation a little bit. I love being in a library, just surrounded by that many people's thoughts, even. Like, I think there's just something magical about that.
Yeah, it is. To me, books are not only things of beauty, but they're also expressive of a kind of magic. Mm-hmm. There is this animistic quality to them. I'm convinced of it. I can sense that spiritual principle in any book, regardless of whether it's a book about spirituality or not. I can sense that animistic principle in all of them.
Yeah.
That there is something of the author in there. There is something of a subject that they're writing about in there. And then there's this other quantity, an unknown quantity for the author, which is the reader. And it all becomes this beautiful tripartite structure of relationship. And I just love being a part of it. And mm-hmm. to be an author, I continuously have to pinch myself that I get to put those things out in the world. It's crazy. And I'll never get over it.
I hope so. I hope you do never get over it. I hope it always has that much joy. Before we get to our game of chance question at the end, I want to make sure to give you an opportunity to plug what's coming up for you, what's coming out. This book will be out by the time people hear this, because this will be out. I moved my thing and now I have to check. I think this episode comes out on my son's birthday, so September 6th.
Lovely. Yeah, so the Book of Druidry will be out. So the Book of Druidry comes out in July. And then in September, I have another project coming out called the Yule Tarot. So even though I'm a druid and I like to write books about Celtic mythology and Celtic worldview, my other love is tarot. Tarot is, I guess, what brought me into this world to begin with, or gave me the impetus to explore the unseen and the unknown. And it was tarot deck that kind of did that, you know? So I'm obsessed with tarot cards. I've just had a brand new deck today. Oh, I keep buying decks. It's just dreadful.
Yeah, I know. It's such an addiction. I have it too.
I know. So I've got the Yule Tarot coming out in September, and then the Bee Tarot comes out next April. Oh, April wow. of 2024. Okay. And that one is absolutely stunning because we keep bees here at home. I say we, the royal we. So my partner keeps the bees and I look on, you know, from a distance. But they're very much a part of our lives. So, and I wanted to have that reflected in tarot. So, and the Yule one is very beautiful and whimsical. It's a bit like a children's illustrated book that captures the archetypes of the midwinter season from all different traditions, that the minor arcana reflects humankind's connection to the season. So, you know, so when we're looking at the Suit of Pentacles, it is all about, you know, the money that we spend and the gifts that we buy and all of that sort of stuff is in there. Oh, but lovely. It's beautiful, and it's illustrated by an American artist called Erin Leary O'Brown, who lives in upstate New York. So she worked with me to design and bring out these beautiful cards. But then I've just finished doing the edits for the Bee Tarot book, and the books that Llewellyn produce are quite sumptuous. You know, they're like 300 pages, full color. So I still get to write, not just design the cards, but I also get to get the freedom to write these books and explore the nature of whatever the subject is that I'm focusing on. And then I'm currently working on another project. You know, so yeah, but that will be going back to, you know, my, well, they're all, I suppose, in one way or another, related to the Celticity that's at the heart of my spiritual practice. But the next book will be focusing, have a slightly different focus to what I usually write about. So I'm excited about that.
Exciting. And where can folks find you if they want to find your books or all that?
So they can find me by going to llewellyn.com, two L's at the beginning and two L's in the middle, Llewellyn. And just looking for Christopher Hughes, or put Christopher Hughes in the search bar with a K and two Fs. Or they can find me on Facebook. I have a public profile on Facebook, and I also have a profile on TikTok and Instagram. I'm getting the hang of TikTok ever so slowly, but I'm 50. You know, it's like it's a different experience to me than it is for somebody who's 22. But I try.
I have what I call a catch only account on TikTok. It is anonymous, and I just look at other people's stuff. I don't post. So.
It's kind of addictive. I have to be careful because
it can be a time suck. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, such a time suck when I could be reading
or writing or podcasting or whatever. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, so I'm on all the social medias, and I'm fairly active. I'm probably most active on Facebook, but that kind of tells you how old I am.
You know. It is what it is, right? Yeah. So for our last question, this is kind of our game of chance at the end. I always joke, though I'm not great at astrology, I do kind of lean hard on the fact that I'm a double Scorpio and I don't know how to do small talk. So I will roll a die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want. And they all are related to your work or writing.
Right.
Okay. I try not to like just completely blindside people. Right. So two. Sex.
Oh.
You want this one? There are no rules. You can also say pass.
I'm happy with that one.
Okay. This was the hardest question for me to write because you don't talk about this in your book at all. So I had to come up with a question. So I was thinking about one of the things you say in the book is that Druidry is very welcoming of people of all different gender identities and sexual orientations. And so what else should people know about Druidry and sex?
What else should they know? Oh my gosh. Oh my word.
Like, what would you tell people if they ask you, like, you know, Druidry and sex? Go.
So. I think sex is something that's very much celebrated in Druidry, not just as something that has a function of procreation, but also as a function of celebration, and is indicative of celebrating the intimate relationships that people are in. But we do very much have a focus on consent, and that any form of sexual expression should have consent and be consensual. That should be at its heart. But that also the fact that we are sensuous beings that live in a sensuous world, and that although sensuality and sexuality are necessarily mutually exclusive, there is a crossover point between the two. And I think eroticism, sensuality, sexuality can all swim together rather beautifully, especially if done well, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that as a druid, the sensations and the emotions that are expressed during sex are very much in line with the primary force within druidry, which is Awen, which is the force of creation moving through creation. And that when we're engaged and enjoying sexual activities, we have a sense of that power, of that force and its potentiality flowing through us, you know, and bringing color and vitality and joy to the people who are engaged in it. So yeah, sex is something that is never avoided or frowned upon in druidry, but celebrated and embraced as a beautiful facet of the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I like that. Yeah.
Very much so.
Well, and I do think that's one of the advantages of being in kind of a pagan, druid, witchy space, is that we do tend to be sex positive. I mean, you know, all types, you know, all types included, but, and that includes people who are asexual or aromantic, like they're free to be part of this too, that there's not a requirement.
Yes, exactly. And druidry as well is not particularly, it's not a binary system. Mm-hmm. It's a very fluid system. So people, I think of different gender expressions do tend to feel very comfortable within druidry because there isn't an emphasis on the binary as being that which is normative. Mm-hmm. That you can play with the forces between those.
Yeah.
And I think people feel very comfortable in druidry when it comes to the freedom to express their gender identity or gender preferences or sexual preferences, and that they won't be judged, but celebrated.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's one of the things about druidry that appeals to me. I mean, I have this, you know, from reading books, like I have never experienced a druid ceremony or ritual. And, but I do love that it's one of those things that seems, so comfortable. Like you can be a Buddhist and you can be druid, you can be a Christian and be a druid, you can be an atheist and be a druid. It doesn't matter. The druidry is, and I think you explained this so beautifully in the beginning of the book, but to call it druidry instead of druidism is something you do.
Yeah. Something it's very much do. A verb.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much something that we do. And that we strive towards as well, because essentially to be a druid is to be oak wise, or to strive to be oak wise as the old oak. And that can be incorporated into so many different traditions. We have a bucket full of witches and Wiccans who are members of the Anglesey Druid Order. Mm-hmm. And so much of our actual praxis is very difficult to distinguish from witchcraft. Very difficult. If you saw some of the stuff that we get up to in the Grove on the sixth night of the new moon every month, you'd be like, these are witches. You know, these are practicing witchcraft. And essentially we are practicing witchcraft. And but we might call it something else within my language, mm-hmm. within Welsh.
Right.
We don't have a word for witchcraft in Welsh. So we have a different word that doesn't have the same connotations, but it's essentially the same thing.
Oh, that's lovely. Christopher, thank you so much for joining me and talking about your joy of books and writing. Like, this has just been such a lovely conversation, and I hope people enjoy it as much as I have.
Hopefully they will. Hopefully, I'm sure they will.
Awesome. Well, when your next project is out, give me, you know, shoot me an email. Let's do this again.
Oh, yes, I'd love to. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.